Hey everyone, this is Chris Woodruff. You know what? This is the start of a new podcast. It's been a while since I did one, and you know from the introduction episode what the podcast is all going to be about. But this one, you know what? It took me a while. I sat down and thought about who I wanted to have on as the first guest. I do have to say this person has been an inspiration to me over many beers and many discussions. I don't agree with him and he doesn't agree with me, but you know what? Overall, we always have a good time when we chat. So I'd like to welcome Daryl Miller to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Tell the audience a little about yourself, kind of a little bit about your background and maybe a little bit about how you got into using REST and developing REST APIs.
Sure. Well, I'm pretty much a developer at heart and have been for the longest time. I spent most of my career developing boring old line of business, battleship gray type applications. But over the last couple of years, I've been doing more of an evangelist role. I kind of got involved in more in the community, more doing talks and stuff, and spent a year working at Runscope, who do HTTP debugging tools. And then for the last 6 months, I've been working at Microsoft as an API evangelist, working with the API management team.
Awesome. So I assume that's a lot around Windows Azure, right?
Yes. API management is a cloud service based in Azure. Yeah.
Yep. So we're going to start out from the beginning. So let's assume that someone's listening to this. They don't know very much about REST APIs. They don't know very much about REST itself. And so let's give this person kind of the, as we used to say in the deep fried bites world, the shiny pennies and the rusty washers. Let's talk about the good things, but let's talk about some of the gotchas and the ugly side of REST APIs and some of the things that can get you in trouble. So, I mean, what do you think are maybe the top five things that someone should know before they really want to get into REST APIs?
I think probably the most important thing for anybody to know about the phrase REST is that as you start to get involved with it, you will run into 101 different definitions of it. It's unfortunately one of those terms that means so many different things to so many different people. That's kind of a product of the fact that as it was originally defined, it was defined as a style. It wasn't designed prescriptively with specific, this is how you do it. It was designed much more of, well, if you want to achieve these long-term effects, then avoid doing these things and do these things. That's caused a tremendous amount of confusion, especially as people partially understand it and partially start to learn about it. And then they have some success and they say, oh, you know what? I'm going to write a best practices article or I'm going to design a framework to make this easier. And their particular approach to doing REST that has worked for them before then becomes, well, this is how you do REST, which somebody else who has a different context, maybe that doesn't work for them. So that's probably the worst problem is that everybody kind of can do it different ways. And it is, you can do it right a whole bunch of different ways. You can also do things that are not matching REST, but still perfectly right because the context is appropriate. So let me be more precise, right? One of the big goals of, we'll call it pure REST, is to build evolvable systems that last over the time of 10 and 15 years, things that adapt to change over a long time. And that's not always a requirement. for people when they're building a software project. You might be building a prototype. You might be building something to support some event that's coming down the road in 6 months. And after that event, you might not need the software anymore. It may be software to solve a particular business problem, and the business is going to change, so it's no longer an issue further down the road. So evolvability may not be a major concern. So therefore, some of the rules and regulations that allow you to build things that last a really long time may not be appropriate. And that's where we get into this whole, well, I'm a REST pragmatist versus one of those REST purists type of debates, which really, you know, it doesn't really help anybody. It just ends up labeling people and people get upset, and it's not particularly constructive. The key is to really understand what it is you're trying to achieve and what kind of behaviors you want your software to have.
Inspired by APIs and topics discussed during the show, feeling it's something you want to try and master, start by choosing the right tools. JetBrains delivers intelligent software solutions that make developers more productive by simplifying their challenging tasks, automating the routine, and helping them adapt the best development practices. JetBrains Rider, a cross-platform .NET IDE for professional developers, provides the complete set of tools to be productive developing .NET and .NET Core solutions. Go to www.jetbrains.com/rider and get a 30-day trial. Now back to the show. So where does REST come from? So we haven't even said what REST stands for either, have we?
Yeah, but I mean, really, does that really help? It stands for Representational State Transfer.
Anyone would know what that really means.
That's right, and really, it was something that was invented in reverse after the fact, when the early versions of HTTP, versions like 0.9 and 1.0, were actually becoming really popular, and the web was growing. They started to see scalability issues with the way things were built. And they were like, okay, we need to fix some of these things. And that's there were certain goals that they were trying to achieve in making changes to the HTTP protocol to bring out version 1.1. And one of the people involved in the work on HTTP 1.1 was Roy Fielding. And after 1.1 was released and into the wild, he was at University of Irvine, California at the time doing, and he was studying, and he had to do a PhD dissertation. So he did a PhD dissertation on principled design. You know, this is really, you know, software, it's called software engineering for a reason. We chose, you know, certain constraints that we want to respect in order to get certain characteristics out of our software. And in one chapter in his dissertation, he uses the example of what they did when designing HTTP 1.1 as an example of this principle design. And he explained the constraints that they applied in order to achieve the scalability and evolvability for HTTP 1.1. So REST was an example of a style of building a network-based system, which is the underpinnings of why they did the things that they did when creating HTTP 1.1.
So do you think everyone needs to go out and read Fielding's dissertation?
I suppose the easy answer to that is no. It's definitely not the most approachable piece of material. It's one of those things that as you learn more about REST, and if you want to dig deeper into its ability to make systems last a long time, it's worth going back to it every now and again. Like, I don't think I've ever sat down and said, okay, today I'm going to read the dissertation from end to end. I've gone back and referred to certain paragraphs and read them over and over again until one day finally it's like, oh, that's what he's talking about. It's not something that is easily digestible. And pretty much if you read any of Roy's writing, it's not something, it's the kind of writing that once you understand what he's talking about, then it makes an absolute ton of sense. But unfortunately, it's not the place to learn really about how it works.
Yeah. Yeah. That was kind of a softball question. So I also tell people they don't really have to read that dissertation. It doesn't really, I mean, they may at some point. It's kind of like, do I think people should read the entire spec of HTTP?
Oh, well, you see, no. There I'd say yes, no. Absolutely.
Oh, you would? Oh, okay, okay, well.
I'm a big fan of going to the source for those kind of things, but there's a reason why, and it's because I've got used to reading them, and there's a lot of, especially with the IETF specs, there's a lot of consistency between them. So because I've had practice, they're actually quite easy for me to read, because they tend to be fairly concise. They don't repeat themselves, because if they have anything that they repeat, they just point to some other spec, which if I'm lucky, I've already read that other spec. The problem is, like, there's a barrier of entry there, right? You kind of have to be familiar with the body of work, because until you are, every single time you go and read one thing, you've got to read four other specs to understand that one thing. But once you've got over those initial hurdles, it is actually useful. And you know what? The more recent specs, that they updated the HB specs recently and changed the old RFC 2616 into five specs, 7230 up to 7235. And they're written a lot better now.
Oh, well, that's good. That's good.
There's less ambiguity in there. Okay, they're longer, but there is a lot of clarity. But again, it's still fairly dry writing, because it's intended to be dry writing, right?
Yeah. So let's say you don't read it at 10 o'clock on a Friday night after you've had a long week at work, right?
Well, unless you want to put yourself to sleep, right?
Oh, yeah, I guess insomniacs could read it, so... Cool. Now, the one thing I know that you and I both have kind of a love for, and you know, it might be sick and twisted, but I know we both love HTTP response codes, and also some of the we love talking about like verbs and how to use the verbs. So tell me a little bit about how you kind of see. I call it the language of HTTP, because you have REST, which kind of transfers entities around, and what I see is JSON. And then we have verbs, and then we have like response code. So in there, we can communicate very well with the clients that are communicating with our APIs. So, I mean, what's your take on all that?
Well, I think for me, when I finally understood what HTTP was trying to do, I realized that it had already solved a whole bunch of problems that I was trying to solve myself. See, when I first got into trying to build distributed business applications where I had a server component and a client component, it was back in the days of WCF and SOAP, and you defined this interface to the service, and you said, okay, great, this is my service interface now. Well, what methods am I going to put into this interface? And, well, you can put anything. You can create a method that has a whole bunch of small parameters or a large payload. And, what am I going to return? Well, okay, well, I need to return this information, but then I also need to return some status information. So how shall I structure the return types? And there was just a ton of decisions to make as to, well, how do I enable this communication between the client and the server in order to solve my business problem and in order to build a reliable distributed system? And what HTTP does is it actually gives you a head start. It says, okay, here's a way that we've already proven works, right? Here are a bunch of status codes that already cover the common cases of what can happen when you communicate across the wire to some other system. And here's how we suggest that you return your data and your metadata about that data. Because we always find that in building distributed systems, there's always some metadata that you want to kind of bundle along. And, well, HTTP already has this notion of headers and suggests this is how you use headers in order to convey metadata. So some people kind of look at HTTP as, well, this is kind of plumbing and I don't want to deal with that. Like it's extra work to understand that. I just want a clean abstraction on top. Whereas I look at it the other way around and say, no, HTTP has done a big chunk of the work for me. All I have to do is add my extra business stuff into there, and I've kind of solved all the distributed computing problem, which is a bit of an oversimplification, but you know what sure. I mean, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I would say you're leveraging the internet, what the internet is. So, you know what? We're building in software on top of the internet. Why not use what the internet gives us to help build that? It's already proven.
Right.
It's already, there's specs out there. Other people have tested it. It seems the internet seems to be working pretty well. So why not leverage what makes the internet so great?
Yeah.
And then go from there.
Yeah. And I mean, you bring up status codes as one example, right? So people often look at status codes and they go, yes, but these status codes aren't descriptive enough to tell me what went wrong. And that's absolutely true. Like, you know, the 400 status code that says it's a bad request, it doesn't tell the client application why it's a bad request. Because you can add additional payloads to say why. But what is important to the client is, okay, it's a bad request. Well, what can I do about that? Well, really, because a 400 mean or a 400 class of error means it's a client error, it means the client should take that response and say to the whoever created that request, oh, you did something wrong, you should fix it. If it's a 500 class of error, well, the client has to take a different approach, because in that case, well, it's not something that the client did wrong, it's something that the server did wrong. Right? And there's nothing that the client can do to fix that. Well, unless like it's a 502, which is, you know, the server's not available and there's a retry header, which is a hint to the client to say, oh, well, it's not going to work at the moment, but if you retry after 10 seconds. So it's absolutely true that the status codes do not convey enough information to say why there's a problem, but they convey enough information to tell the client what they could do about it. Which is an interesting, subtle distinction. And you can definitely layer the why it happened on top, but the most important thing is what action is the client going to take. And if you take HTTP methods, right? So we've got the get, the put, the post, the delete. Again, I always the reason for those methods primarily is to enable the HTTP layered architecture, right? So in HTTP, you don't just have a client talking to a server. You have a client talking to a proxy server that's talking to an ISP's gateway machine, which is talking to some firewall, which is talking to some load balancer. And then eventually they're going to get to potentially a backend origin server. And the methods are, you choose the methods to communicate some information to those intermediary pieces that are going along the wire so that maybe they can contribute to the overall system. You know, an example of that being if you're doing a GET request, we know it's a safe request, and therefore a cache that is sitting between the client and server might be able to return a response without communicating all the way back to that backend server. If we didn't have those methods kind of annotating the requests, we would not be able to take advantage of these intermediary components. So, I mean, that's really, if we didn't have those intermediary components, then the methods are overly simplistic to really be able to help you build real applications, which is why so many people fall into the trap of, oh, well, the only thing REST is any good for is for building CRUD, because all we can do is get, put, post, and delete, and those map to create, read, update, and delete. And that's just, it's an not only is it an oversimplification of what you can do, but that's not really why they're there. They're there to communicate information to intermediary components. At least that's my opinion.
Sure. No, and you know what? Everyone, I mean, like you said in the beginning of the episode, everyone has a different take on everything. I think it's perfectly fine for someone to come in the beginning of their use of REST and go, you know what, I want to use REST for CRUD. And then they stick their toe into the water, and then they learn, and then they expand. I mean, that's how I kind of got into REST, and I'm still digging into it, and I'm still learning. I don't think I'll ever probably understand everything with the internet. There's just a lot of pieces. But yeah, I mean, it's that beautiful thing where I just, when it clicked, I just sat there and said, wow. I mean, it came together. And I think the use of the I call them HTTP verbs, but they are methods, and the response codes together are what kind of give me a lot of power as an API developer. So,
well, they give you Rails. It's funny, I've never actually made that correlation. They give you Rails to build something on, right? I mean, that's where the name Rails came from, right? For Ruby on Rails. It was like, here's a set of guidelines, a set of conventions to help you build applications. Well, that's what HTTP is for building distributed applications. It's like, follow these rules and you'll build something that will be able to scale.
Yeah, and I think you hit on something there where you said distributed. And so for me, distributed just means stateless. And that's the other thing that people have to realize with REST. It's stateless. You can't, I mean, you call something and you can't assume that back end remembers anything other than, well, it doesn't remember anything. It has no short-term memory. It just remembers that it has to grab the next payload coming to it and react to the method that's in the header, right?
Right, right. But I think there's more to distributed insofar as there's a difference in control, right? Insofar as when you're building this is interesting. I bumped into this a little while ago. I often use the term distributed system, but distributed systems is also referred to, like, if you have, a multi-core CPU where there are multiple CPUs and there's a load shared between them, or you've got some kind of cluster, a Hadoop cluster, that's a distributed system, but they're all homogeneous kind of nodes within that system. Whereas if you actually, in Fielding's dissertation, he calls it a network-based system, which is an interesting distinction. And I think the fact that when you're building REST-based systems like on the web, what is very common is, first of all, you've got a fairly significant latency between a client and a server. And also, those two components of the system are probably owned by two completely different organizations. So the control structure of when changes happen, when software is deployed on those components, you can't coordinate the deployment of software on those two systems. So they have to be able to change independently and still work to be effective. Right? I mean, if every time we upgraded a browser, we had to go and update all of our web servers at the same time, the web would never really have worked, right? It's only because we can independently evolve web browsers independent of websites that the web works.
Yeah. So what do you think? I mean, we've talked a lot about what you should know on the, we'll say on the producing side of APIs, but What do you think people should know and developers should know on the consuming side? I assume they have to still know about just what we talked about before. They have to know about HTTP methods and verbs and response codes.
Well, Some people.
But is there anything further that you think that they should know as a consuming APIs?
There's a couple of things, but let's just roll back a minute. I mean, many people don't try and consume APIs using HTTP directly. They'll go to an API provider and they'll download an SDK for their particular language, and they'll use that SDK to make those HTTP calls under the covers, so that they're actually protected and hidden, isolated away from the HTTP completely. And I think that's unfortunate, because I don't think HTTP is as hard as some people think it is to learn, and I think there's a lot of benefits of understanding how it works. Unfortunately, API providers are kind of stuck with this. Well, we want as many people as possible to use our API, and therefore we're going to build these SDKs to make it really easy. That's an unfortunate side effect of where we are in the industry. I hope as time goes on, more and more people will feel more comfortable using just native HTTP libraries to be able to make calls.
I think that's exactly what people should do. I mean, I was talking to a buddy of mine earlier today, and he was talking about a library. I can't remember the name of the library for iOS. And he was like, he was just raving about it. And I go, yeah, but you already know about how to do it natively in most OSs. So it's fine for you to kind of pick up a framework that helps you out, kind of cut some corners and get things done quickly. But I agree, most new developers to this, I think that they should at least dabble in it and play around with it a little bit just to understand the basics of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I mean, if you go back 30, 40 years, when the term RPC was originally coined, the idea of RPC was it was a client-side piece of infrastructure code that allowed a client-side developer to make what they looked like a regular procedure call, local call, but in actual fact, under the covers, was making a remote call. It's funny today you hear people kind of use RPC you're not doing REST, you're doing RPC, talking about the server side, when it's really not a server side issue at all. It's very much a client side and the way that we interact with a library in order to make that remote request. And there's so much more richness to the HTTP protocol and all of its status codes in order to handle failure conditions. And when you push the responsibility onto the API provider to produce a library that does all that work for you, they've got to make decisions for you. They've got to decide, well, how do you want to handle this particular failure condition? Do you consider it fatal, or is it something that your app can live without? Like, but they don't have that knowledge of how you're going to use that API necessarily. So they have to make all these difficult decisions, and then they have to now produce a library in multiple different languages in order to support all of their customer base. So unfortunately, a lot of those client-side libraries don't have necessarily all the richness that they could possibly have, because API providers just don't have the time and money to produce an extremely feature-rich HTTP client library for every single platform and every single library. So there's so many advantages to being able to understand how to make those calls yourself and know how it's actually working and take control of those finer level details.
Yeah, like I can give you an example. So I'm working on a project, and it's an Angular front end, and we're calling some REST APIs in the back end, and they're produced using ASP.NET Web API 2. And everything's fine. We do have a lot of cross-domain calls. So we are doing a lot of pre-flight.
Right, the CORS requests.
Yeah, the CORS requests. And for the most part, our pre-flight come back with 200s. 200 means, you know, everything's good. I'm available for this other domain to call my service and proceed. And then about 3 or 4 days ago, I started getting 302s in response to my CORS requests. And let me explain. So I make a request to a URL, which is my full URL to hit my API. Has all my parameters. It's a full URL that I'm going to call to get to do something. But I have the options HTTP verb or method on that to say, you know, I just want to ping it and get back that I'm allowed to use it. And then I also have authorization header because I have a token and blah, blah, blah. So I started getting this 302 coming back. And it was pointing me to the ADFS server.
Right.
So somehow, and I still haven't solved it, it's only affecting me on a local machine, like debugging it locally. And it works fine on production and our dev, our intermediate dev CI machine or CI servers. So I'm just sitting there and but to take a step back, I can't use our software is not smart enough to say, oh, I got a 302. What do I do with this 302? I'm going to redirect and do something.
Yep.
It just comes back and says, oh, it just barfs.
Yes. Yes. That's right. Because that's not what it was expecting, right?
Because it wasn't what it was expecting, and no one who designed this or the I don't know what we're using actually under the covers. I can't remember the library, the Angular library that we're using, but that doesn't handle 302s, or at least it doesn't expose a way easily to handle 302s on our CORS pre-flight responses.
Yeah, yeah. And can you imagine how many libraries out there support doing automatic retries, right? You know, you get a 502 with a retry header. A library should be more than capable of recognizing, oh, this is a 502, there's a retry, let's wait, and then let's reissue the request. And your application, in theory, shouldn't have to worry about it at all, because the library should be smart enough to do it. But so many of them aren't. And there's so many other scenarios. The other interesting one is a new status code that came out, it was probably a couple of years ago now, is called the 511. And that's the captive portal. You're in an airport or you're in a hotel, and you know you have that little pop-up dialogue where you go to say, yes, I agree to the terms and conditions. Well, if you're using an app and it tries to hit the Wi-Fi, a lot of the times it'll just crash if you haven't done that little dance to agree to the terms. So they introduced a new status code called a 511, which was supposed to inform the mobile app, oh, well, you can't connect to the network, not because the network's down or the internet's down, but because you need to go through this agreeing to the terms and conditions type of thing. But I'm confident that a vast majority of client libraries produced by API providers out there have just not even tried to implement that capability.
Well, they might not even know about it, well, to be honest.
That's true, right? So, but these are the kind of things that status codes allow you to do some really quite elegant error recovery. And we're kind of throwing a lot of that away. What I actually tell people to do when building clients, one of the pieces of advice is kind of build your client code that's consuming an API with a sort of air of distrust of the person who is building the API. And it's not because they're a bad guy or a bad girl. They have built an API based on a certain set of requirements, specifications, with a certain set of assumptions, but things change. Right. And because yesterday the resource was here and today it's moved over here and they've now done a redirect there. If you as a client developer don't make assumptions. Well, it's always going to be this way, and it's never going to change. If you build your code, you know, you get a response back that's a JSON body. And in the documentation, it says it has property A, B, and C. If you assume that A, B, and C is always going to be there, and then one day one of those properties isn't there, or there's a new property D, and your code breaks, well, why is it breaking, right? It shouldn't need to. Like, your A, B, and C is still there, or maybe you only need B and C. So you should be able to have resilient code on the client that can deal with new properties appearing that you don't recognize, or if a property disappears that used to be there, then give it, assume a default value. Right, you should be able to be resilient to these kind of changes instead of just, you know, oh, something changed. I'm going to throw up my arms and, well, what do with mobile apps now? We just shut them down, right? We don't even display an error message anymore. We just shut them down so the user thinks that they made a mistake.
Yeah. So I think what we're telling developers on the client side is, you know, it's good. If you find a good library out there that can help you cut time and develop easier against an API, you know, it's fine to do that, but you know what, make sure that whatever you're using can be adaptive, and also understand some of the underpinnings of what those libraries are doing. I mean, maybe if it's an open source library, go in and read over the code so you understand what is going on. And maybe, just maybe, if you find something that's lacking, maybe it doesn't understand the 511, or maybe it doesn't understand when you're getting a 302, and you write some code to help it, and you can give it back to that open source project and help out everyone else. So who knows? You can do that. So let's switch gears a little bit and talk about, we can either, and I'll let Daryl decide, we can either talk about the dark side of REST, if there is a dark side, or we can talk about things that maybe developers do wrong with REST that maybe they shouldn't. And I know REST isn't a hard architecture term. And like you said in the beginning, you can do a lot with it. And some of it's maybe not what other people would do with it. But tell me a few things, maybe what people shouldn't do.
Okay, sure. Well, I think I have a few suggestions, and I think it's not that the ideas themselves are wrong, but they just tend to take people down a path that is going to make their lives more difficult further down the road. And I got two particular things. One of them is what I like to call objects over the wire. And this is this perception that, I'm making a call over HTTP, and I'm going to call an API, and it's going to return a payload, which is basically just a serialization of an object, and then it's going to bring that object over the wire, and we're going to deserialize it, and we have an object on the other side. I think there's a number of dangerous things that happen with that is that, especially if it's very easy to fall into the trap of taking business entities on the server side and exposing those, because we have lots of tools that are very good at just taking our business entities and making them available to serialize over the wire, and we've got these automatic serializers that can do all of this work for us, and unfortunately, in doing so, in taking that kind of short path, we tend to create some fairly tight coupling between the client and the server. So if the shape of the object changes on the server, then implicitly the shape of the object kind of needs to change on the client side, because often those serializers that serialize and deserialize aren't very tolerant to changes. You know, some of them are more, some of them are less. You get into situations where you're going across different platforms and, well, the serializer on this platform does things a little bit differently than the serializer on another platform. So there's a design issue now we have this object going across the wire that contains this particular set of properties from our domain and design thing. But then we want to present some additional information, contextual. Well, now do we make two requests over the wire to get that secondary set of piece of information? Or do we augment our object and kind of pollute our domain object with this extra information just for UI concerns? So quickly that kind of deteriorates down into, well, let's not serialize objects over the wire, let's serialize view models over the wire. But that has its own set of coupling issues. It's a better step, but it's just that initial premise that, oh, well, all I'm doing is just taking an object and moving it across the wire is an oversimplification that it just ends up tripping people up over and over again as a project evolves. So that's one thing that it's good to kind of recognize. It might not work for you. The other one is design by URL is what I like to call it, which is where somebody says, okay, here's an API that I want to design. Okay, so what we're going to do is in our URL, the first segment is going to be this, and then the second segment is going to be that, and then the third one is going to be this, and trying to kind of horizontally create a consistent structure across the path segments. So there's kind of an order to the whole URI space. And the challenge there is, I mean, first of all, the question is, well, why are we trying to create this order to the URI space? And one of the reasons often is because over on the client side, people are constructing URIs, which again is kind of a tight coupling between the client and the server. One maybe you can live with, but then maybe you are going to suffer because of. Again, be aware of the design choices that you're making in these processes. But by creating this consistent structure in the URI, you're kind of tying your hands. And one of the problems in designing in APIs, especially when you're dealing with HTTP that only has, you know, basically the four or five methods available to you, as soon as you want to do something outside of those methods, like some other behavior that doesn't fit into the standard kind of CRUD, what you usually need to do is create special resources that have special behaviors. And if you've kind of designed your API to have this structure, this nice uniform structure across the entire API, then all of a sudden when you start trying to create new resources for these special behaviors, they won't fit into your URI structure. So you'll get into this kind of tension of, oh, well, I need this resource to be able to do this, but it doesn't really fit. I found I to a large extent, I let my resource paths, my resource design grow organically. And the advantage I found in the work that I've done using Hypermedia is because the client is just following links that are embedded in responses returned, it doesn't really care what the structure of the URL looks like. So it doesn't really matter. And if I build some kind of structure that, well, I need to reorganize it a little later on, it's fine. It's not going to break the clients because I don't have logic on the client side constructing URLs based on some predefined structure. So design by URL is another one of those things that it can just cause unnecessary difficulty if you do that.
Yeah. So the other thing you brought up, something that jogged my mind, and it's query projection. So I think today people hit and consume APIs like we used to hit and consume relational databases back in the 90s with 4G programming tools, where we just go, select star from table, and we just get everything back. And what I always tell people is, remember, you're building these APIs, and you don't know what clients are going to be using them. And you have to be adaptive, where you might want have clients that go, you know, I don't want an entire serialized object or a collection. I just want four or five pieces of certain things, and I'll tell you what I want, and you'll send them back, and then we'll all be happy. Well, on the other side, it's the same thing. I mean, I always tell people, never go and get everything. If you can, just get what you need, because you're developing maybe a mobile application that is going to be used in places that don't have high-speed mobile cellular networks.
Right.
And your software is going to be needed to be adaptive to those environments. So why not make it use the least amount of payload sizes, going and sending and returning that you need. And so I think a lot of times too many people bring everything across the wire to a client and send it all the way back, and they don't use most of it.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's what I always say, that I think the biggest mistake that API developers and consumers do also.
That's really interesting that you correlated it back to the select star versus select a particular set of fields, because I have a similar analogy back to the days of SQL databases, relational databases, but that has a different spin on the same story. And that is, building APIs is a lot like the discussion that we used to have between DBAs and developers, where the DBAs said, you're not executing SQL directly against the database, because if you do that, I don't know what kind of query you're going to run, and I can't optimize for it. So you are going to call only the stored procedures that I create for you. So the point there is, on the one hand, if you take the types of APIs like the OData's and the GraphQLs and the Sparkles, where you can construct a query client side to select exactly the information that you're interested in. It's good in that you're only getting the information that you're interested in, but it makes it very hard for the server side developer to optimize for it, because there's such a vast set of permutations of ways that a client can ask for data. So there's an intermediate step there where you can, you know, I completely agree with you. There is absolutely no point in pulling down all of the data all of the time. But maybe there's a way that in the API you could have, say, three different variants, like a minimal, a normal, and a maximum type of representation that are predefined.
Exactly. Yep.
So now we only have three permutations. We can cache just those three different ones. The server-side developer can optimize for those three different cases. And the client developer has to choose the one that is the closest to what they want. So there's a compromise there, right? I can't get exactly just the information that I need, but hopefully I can get it faster because the server-side developer has been able to optimize for just that smaller number of cases.
Yeah. Yep. Nope, I totally agree. And then, me being from the OData world, we kind of do that. We have a full rich set where you get all the metadata coming back along with the data.
Yep.
And then we can also turn off that metadata and not return that. And then we have even smaller forms and more tighter forms of JSON that we can use to just send back very quiet,
right,
JSON that doesn't have very much other than the data that is needed. So, nope, I totally agree with you that sometimes that is good to allow and set up those permutations out of the box for developers to use. I mean, it's, you're making their jobs easier, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're making optimization easier too.
Right? Exactly.
But you got to choose the right things, right? There's no point choosing permutations that nobody wants to use, right?
Yeah. Well, and that's where, I mean, that, and maybe in another podcast, we can, someone will talk about versioning and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So, but that's an entirely different subject that we could talk forever about too. So Daryl, I'm going to have a new tradition on this podcast. So at the end of every podcast, I'm going to thank the guest for coming on, but I'm also going to ask a guest to give me a tool, a library, a product, something that a API producer or consumer can bring into their tool belt and make their job easier. So give me, since you're the very first guest, you get the wide horizon. Yeah, you get the entire horizon of tools and libraries and technologies. So what do you think beginning developers should gravitate to?
Well, I mean, we've talked so much about HTTP and how it is so fundamental to building web APIs on the web, and how important it is to understand how it works to be able to leverage it. And I think one of the tools that's helped me the most in learning how it works is being able to watch traffic that goes over the wire, and that's with Fiddler. And I mean, there are other tools out there. You have the company I used to work for, Runscope. They do the same kind of thing, but in the cloud. And I know there's tools like Charles Proxy on the Mac. And so this is a tool that you can just kind of turn it on, and you can sit and look at traffic that's going backwards and forwards between applications that are running on your machine and the web. And you can look at the headers that are being created. You can look at the bodies, and you can learn so much stuff. And Fiddler has all sorts of cool features, being able to, you can replay requests, you can record them, you can send them, you can filter things out. There's just so many features in that particular tool. But just being able to visualize and see the traffic that's going backwards and forwards can teach you so much about what to do right and what to do wrong, because there's a lot of stuff going across the wire that really shouldn't be going across the wire too.
Yeah. Yeah. You can discover interesting things that you didn't know were running on your computer by using Fiddler. But I totally agree. I mean, Fiddler is one of the first tools when I repave a laptop or set up a new laptop, I always put Fiddler on there. Because just like you said, I can do everything from just watch everything, or I can go right down to one application and filter out everything but what I want to look at and take a look and see at real time what's going on, and then also go back in time and kind of be a detective and do a Sherlock Holmes in my calls and my responses. So great suggestion.
One of the things that I use a lot now, which I didn't for the longest time, is you can create requests just in the simple composer, but there's also this tab called the scratch pad. And the scratch pad is basically just a plain text document, and you can drag and copy requests into there, but you can actually just put the HTTP request like plain text as a set of lines. And you can put a whole bunch of requests in there, and you just highlight the lines that you want to execute, and you hit execute. And it's a really cool reminder that HTTP is just a string of characters that are being sent over the wire. There's really, at the core of it, it is a very, very simplistic protocol. Now, it's changing with HTTP2, but for the moment, it's just a simple string of text with certain formatting rules, and it's really handy for keeping a bunch of requests around and being able to replay them at a later time and reissue them. It's the best learning tool.
Awesome. Well, thanks. I appreciate it. And I bet our listeners will appreciate that too, if they don't already use Fiddler. So I want to thank you, Daryl, for coming on. We'll get you on again. I'm sure we'll have you on because you got a lot of good ideas on a lot of stuff. And we'll probably take ideas and concepts that we talked about in this episode and dig down even deeper into them. This was a very broad overview of kind of what the podcast is going to be about. So anytime you want to come back, you're more than welcome to.
Well, it was great being here. It was fun having the conversation. You know, I always like chatting about this stuff.
Oh, I know you do. That's why I got you on for the first episode. Because I think if you heard this and you weren't the first one, you'd be mad at me. So, but I do want to thank all the listeners out there who are listening and enjoying this. And let me know what you think and give me some ideas around APIs and REST and this whole idea of producing them, consuming them. We'll probably talk about monetizing them in the future, but just let me know your ideas. So thanks everyone, and we will talk to you later. Bye.
Bye.